I am so pleased to present to you Professor Giddings, and I will tell you that she did not travel alone today from Massachusetts. She brought with us Ms. Otto B. Wells, who I hope says she will share more insight and awareness with us. So we welcome both of you.
Good afternoon. Yes. Well, so good to see you. So good to be here. And thank you. I've already had a wonderful day and meeting Shirley and Lynn and Cora and Clifford and being here at this wonderful facility. So thank you very much for coming, and thank you so much for my invitation. Lynn mentioned a little something about Egypt. I, too, as we mentioned, we were talking a little bit about this at brunch this morning. And what an extraordinary event we've been witnessing for the last 2 weeks or so. It does remind you, doesn't it, of the power of people to change. It does remind you of what we are capable of doing. And what's been particularly exciting for me is that young people were involved and at the forefront of this. What's exciting is that they've learned the lessons of Gandhi. They've learned the lessons of Martin Luther King, of Mandela. And the legacy, what's exciting to me is that I think we're very fortunate to have Barack Obama as president, who, remember, had gone over to Cairo and talked about democracy. And so this, you know, we're reminded about this arc bending towards justice. And certainly it's an arc of which on it, at a very important point, is Eleanor Roosevelt, and it's an arc of others, and including, of course, Ida B. Wells, who I am going to talk to you about this afternoon, and trying to make some connections. I know her life pretty well by now, but there are different connections you can make in different times and different periods. Thank you. Okay, and I wanted to talk about something, one particular aspect of her life today. Now, how many of you know pretty much about her biography? Okay, just let me just go and help me along if I get stuck in the weeds, because I can talk, you know, for hours just on one thing. Okay, but let me go a very quick overview of her life before I talk about what I think is the significance of that anti-lynching campaign which she launches in the U.S. and which I argue is really at the foundation of the modern civil rights period and much of what we're seeing, and I hope to see more of in this era. Born in Holly Springs, Mississippi in 1862, born a slave, her parents are slaves. Her father is a skilled, however, carpenter. Her mother is a skilled cook. She's the firstborn of six children in Holly Springs, Mississippi. Has, as she speaks about herself in her autobiography, a good and constructive childhood until 1878. When she is 16 years old, and a yellow fever epidemic sweeps the Mississippi Valley, which kills both of her parents within 24 hours of one another, a young brother, and she will emerge at 16 as the head of her family, that she will take care of herself. She will finally move with two of her sisters to Memphis, Tennessee, to live with an aunt and their children. And there she will be a school teacher, and her activist career will begin in 1883 when she refuses to leave a first-class car on a Chesapeake and Ohio railway. She is extricated from the car physically, not without a fight, though, you know. There's a great transcript available because she takes this the railway to court in 1883. So there's a transcript of all of it. And the conductor who tried to get her out of the seat said, you know, she fought back fiercely, including she took a bite out of my hand. And I bled, you know, profusely. And what I love about it is that, see, this is the weeds, and I'm going to go on now. But what I love about it is that, you know, Ida Wells is a Victorian. I'm going to talk a little bit about Victorian culture today. She's a Victorian. She enters the train, you know, dressed to the nines, with a hat and parasol and gloves, and being the lady that she is. But there is a time when you have to not be a lady and struggle for your rights. And this is always the tension, particularly with African American women, and she's only, you know, she's like 5 feet tall. She's a tiny little thing. But this will begin her activist career, and she's asked to write about this event in as a journalist, and this will begin her journalistic career, and she will eventually co-own a newspaper in Memphis called the Memphis Free Speech. She will go on, she will start, which I will talk about, the anti-lynching campaign, but she will be exiled from the South because of that campaign, finally settle in Chicago, where she'll start a settlement house, where she'll work with the sleeping car porters and A. Philip Randolph, and be very is very important in their success there. We'll create the first black women's suffrage organization in Chicago, which will elect the first black alderman in Chicago. This is a story that's never told. She will finally run for a state Senate seat, first black person to attempt to do that. She will lose, but she leaves a legacy of political activism in Chicago and in Illinois. And so she's just an extraordinary reformist figure. I talk about her campaign against lynching as creating the framework for the modern civil rights movement, not just because of the raw courage. If you can imagine, in the South in 1892, almost alone, talking about challenging lynching in the South, but also it was this physical courage, of course, but she also had a kind of emotional courage, because she was the first person that I could see, at least, that wrote about this, who understood very significant and profound changes in the culture and in America as it's becoming a modern country, and how that is affecting the way race is thought of and realized and defined. And this is why, because, you know, one of the questions you have to ask as a biographer, why is she the first? What does she understand? What is she seeing that others don't see? And this is one of those. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that today. And I want to talk about in the context of what following the journey of an activist like her, excuse me, can teach you about reading the current, even the current society of what's happening now. You know, when, and I'm sure many of you have some similar feelings, but, you know, when Barack Obama was elected, when Hillary Clinton came close to being the nominee with Sonia Mayor, and even Sarah Palin and Michael Steele and Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, I had to ask myself at some point, I mean, do I have to you know, I'm a child of the 60s, so do I have to reimagine America? What is the meaning? What is the significance of this? And it struck me that late 19th century activists, including Ida Wells, had to ask themselves the same question in the 1880s and the 1890s, because there were two developments really pulling in opposite directions in this period of time. On the one hand, and these are things we don't get in our history books so often, in this period, 1880s, I'm talking about late 19th century, early 20th century, on one hand, there were unprecedented in this period, even stunning achievements of blacks, just a generation or so after the end of slavery. Achievements that they, like I think some of us now, thought that they would never see in their lifetimes. After Reconstruction, blacks were more determined than ever to earn the privileges of first-class citizenship as it was defined in the late 19th century. You read this all the time, of their insistence to move beyond their former condition, as they put it themselves, in the society. Sometimes what we forget is that blacks are freed and emancipated right in the middle of the Victorian period. I mean, as if life wasn't going to be hard enough with all those gender protocols. And they try to abide by these cultural ideals. You know, we can best understand, bear with me as I just talk a little bit about this, because you'll understand the significance of Wells when we understand a little bit about the culture that blacks were freed within. We can best understand Victorian behavior when we understand that its essential purpose was to keep baser emotions at bay. You know, this is a period when Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was published. And this is a period in it which really reflects the nervousness of the culture, feeling that if you let the animal within out, it could subsume you and create, make you an evil person and destroy the good in you. So you had to keep things repressed, your baser emotions repressed. So refinement was key. Stability was key. Order was key. Cohesion was key. People couldn't abide side by side with evil. It was too tempting. So it had to be expunged in some way. One cultural historian calls this a radical innocence that the Victorians had. And so there was ample reason to believe in this period that class, not race, but class determined one's character. That class defined one's destiny in America. And this is what gentlemanly behavior and chivalry was about. This is what the cult of true womanhood was about. You know, the ideas of piety and domesticity and purity and submissiveness. This is what cultivating the fine arts and literature was about, keeping these emotions at bay. And Wells herself, you know, when you think about this activist, but when you look at her early life, she's very involved. Wells read all of Shakespeare before she was 16. She read Alcott and Dickens. She yearned to be this kind of refined lady of culture, not for the snob appeal of it, but because this is what was so important a part of your destiny in America at this point of time. And the black elite in general followed this script. This is when black denominations, church denominations, flourished. Education was important because of this. So this is a period between 1880 and 1900. Illiteracy is almost cut by almost a third in the black community. As a result, some 200 newspapers are being published every week because now there's a black audience. There are listed, if you look in those newspapers, you see growing numbers listed of the physicians and teachers and entrepreneurs and tradesmen. And, of course, a small but significant cohort of black women were being educated in places like Oberlin, Fisk, and even the Severn Sister Schools. So this formula for success seemed to be working for a long time. By the turn of the century, the 20th century, there were some 600 black federal political appointments, mostly under Republican presidents, that ranged from postal workers to high appointments in presidential administrations, etc. The first Phi Beta Kappa from Harvard it was in 1894 was granted. A year later, Mary Church Terrell becomes the first black woman appointed to a board of education in Washington, D.C. There are signs of progress everywhere in education, in business, in politics. White progressive reformers who believed that the advance of blacks and the lessening of discrimination was important to the society as a whole provided substantial funds to establish schools, such as Rust College, where Ida Wells went to in Mississippi, to bolster civic institutions and housing and education. This is a period of time when Andrew Carnegie gives Booker T. Washington's Tuskegee Institute $600,000 in 1903. As one African-American observer observed in a major publication in the 1890s, the race question seems to be resolving itself. People, the script was, you work hard, you save your money, you get educated, you will succeed. That is America. So many African-Americans, once slaves, were reimagining America in this period of time. The only problem was there was another development in the U.S. happening exactly at the same time. One was the rise of lynching. The year 1887 marked the first time that the number of black lynching victims exceeded that of whites. You know, lynching is an American phenomenon that starts in the Revolutionary War years and was mostly directed at whites. It begins to change in the 1880s and is directed at blacks. So you can imagine, you're in these black communities where there's so much progress around you. But you will pick up your newspaper and you'll read stories about three or four lynchings happening every week. Sometimes black men and women were, you know, simply hung. On one occasion in Newberry, Florida, five blacks, including two women, were hung in a row from a single oak tree. On other occasions, mobs tortured their victims mercilessly. In one year, a mob of about 1,000, took revenge on a couple who had been accused of killing James Eastland, a member of a prominent Mississippi planter family. They tied the couple to a tree. A fire was prepared beneath them. And while the flames began to burn, their fingers were lopped off one at a time and distributed for souvenirs. Their ears were cut off. The man's eyes were poked out with a stick. Most often, though, the charge of rape accompanied the stories of lynching. In 1892, in the course of 1 week, Ida Wells read in a local white newspaper, the Memphis Commercial, stories about eight lynchings taking place in Little Rock, Arkansas, Anniston, Alabama, New Orleans, Louisiana, and Clarksville, Georgia. The victims were characterized as Negro scoundrels who had raped white women, and the paper editorialized that they represented a new phase of black sexual violence. No man, said the paper, can leave his family at night without the dread that some roving Negro ruffian is watching and waiting for the opportunity to attack some unprotected white woman. People are reading this. In that same year, 1892, lynching hit a new annual peak of 241. It was estimated conservatively that 728 lynchings took place between 1882 and 1991. Accompanying and, in fact, exacerbating this horrible trend was the rise of the modern social sciences in this very period, especially anthropology, that began to codify racial difference, saying and allegedly proving that through the scientific method and observation that blacks were more savage than whites, and thus inferior and lascivious. No less a figure than Daniel Brinton, listen to his creds, a Yale graduate, University of Pennsylvania professor, one-time president of both the International Congress of Anthropology and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, excuse me, in 1890, said this: African Americans had regressed to being, quote, midway between the orangutan and the European white. The correlation to this belief, as Brinton also pointed out, was that blacks were impelled to rape white women because they needed to raise their race to a higher level. This is science. Science. To make pronouncements even more dangerous and consequential, the technological innovations of the period, including electricity, the telegraph, the telephone, increased the dissemination of such ideas throughout the country. So like 24-hour cable now. African Americans did not have to believe the worst of these stereotypes to worry about the behavior of the increasing number of rural, uneducated blacks and whites, by the way, who were pouring into southern cities to find work, somewhat like the immigrants now. At the same time, technological advances also allowed the evils such as prostitution and illicit substances, alcohol, and gambling syndicates to thrive and be distributed as never before. Within this context, the rise of black lynching victims could be easily misunderstood as the violence of the lower classes. Quote, it was the, quote, scum of both races which meet, drink, gamble, and propagate corruption, noted the Christian Index, a Southern black publication in 1891. The Negro is always kindly treated by the intelligent white people, but makes his bitterest enemy among the lower classes of the race. Class, it was thought, not race, was the problem. Ida Wells, like the Index and many blacks of the period, assumed too, as we do now, I think, in some ways, about blacks in the inner city, who are incarcerated, that their antisocial behavior was the problem. But beginning in the late 1880s, Wells, then a newspaper co-owner of the Memphis Free Speech, began to increasingly question the characterization of blacks as rapists who were being murdered because of what was then called the unspeakable crime of rape. And then an incident happened in 1892 that changed her thinking entirely. The lynching of her good friend, Thomas Moss, in Memphis, Tennessee. Moss and two other men worked at the People's Grocery, a co-op owned by leading black citizens in Memphis. Moss also worked as a postman by day, a position that required passing a federal service exam. He was the president of the grocery. In so many ways, he represented the hopes of blacks in what was called then the New South. But earlier that year, a white store owner and competitor initiated a series of provocations that led to a small riot at the location of the grocery that led to Moss, McDowell, and Stewart, the two other men, among dozens of other blacks being arrested and jailed. At 2 a.m. on March 9th, the three men were seized from their cells by 75 masked whites and taken to an abandoned railway yard. They were cruelly tortured. One of the men had his fingers shot off one by one. Another had his eye poked out, his jaw penetrated by a load of buckshot, and a hole in his face and neck large enough for a fist to be inserted. All this was described in the press. The injuries, it was reported in the press, were in accord with his vicious and unyielding nature. One of the whites, it was believed by blacks, was in fact the judge of the criminal court. But to show you how self-conscious about order white Southerners were, remember the Victorian culture. The local Memphis Appeal Avalanche newspaper noted that the lynching was, quote, one of the most orderly of its kind ever conducted. There was no whooping, not even loud talking, no cursing. The vengeance was sharp, swift, sure, but administered with due regard to the fact that people were asleep all around the jail. This image was very important that Wells begins to understand of orderliness. One reason is because of northern capital that is being put into the South for its reconstruction. And capitalists like order. By contrast, Moss and the other two men, upright citizens in the community, had been characterized in the press as criminals and rabble-rousers. The lynching, Wells later wrote, was her first lesson in white supremacy. And its lessons were clear, at least to her. Blacks weren't being killed because they were criminals or because they were raping white women. They weren't being murdered despite the fact that they were achieving, but because they were achieving in a newly competitive, urbanized, and industrial society. The New South, as it was called, and science went out of its way to criminalize blacks, stereotype them so that they could be murdered and incarcerated with impunity. And it wasn't the scum of the white race that was responsible, but leading citizens such as that criminal court judge. Think about the turnaround in thinking that this represented. Class was not the issue. Race was the issue. Criminality was not the issue. Anthropological pronouncements weren't the issue. The issue was the need for rationale that made blacks disreputable monsters who committed the one crime, rape, that, as Wells noted, quote, closed the heart, stifled the conscience, warped the judgment, and hushed the voice of press and pulpit on the subject of lynch law. After the Moss lynching, Wells became one of the nation's first investigative journalists. When Wells began to investigate lynching, sometimes going to the scene of the crime and interviewing witnesses, she found that the crimes of rape often followed the discovery of consensual relationships between black men and white women. This meant, of course, the stereotype of pure white womanhood, an identity upon which white Southern culture depended, was a myth. Furthermore, an analysis of Chicago Tribune's annual lynching statistics revealed that only a third of lynching victims were even accused of rape, much less guilty of it. The others were lynched for alleged crimes that ranged from murder to talking back to white folks. At the same time, as Wells noted in one of the first defenses of black women, they were the ones who were actually sexually exploited at the hands of the so-called leading citizens, a practice that continued after slavery. In order for Wells to follow the logic of lynching to its ultimate conclusions, she herself had to take a deliberate flight from Victorian innocence and embrace modern thinking by replacing gentility with reality, by dispensing with the false delicacy, which she uses, a phrase she uses, of calling rape the unspeakable crime. Ida was one of the few women reformers who actually used the word rape. And like modern thinkers, she dared to peer beneath the surface of the human psyche to report the baser instincts that were taking place. It is with no pleasure I have dipped my hands in the corruption here exposed, she told her readers in the preface of Southern Horrors, her pamphlet. Of course, it was courageous to print such ideas in her free speech newspaper. And as many of you know, she was threatened with lynching herself and driven into exile from her home in the South. But I think it was just as courageous to follow this logic of lynching and to foment a campaign that went against those very cultural notions that had rebuffed activism. A new way of thinking was required to unleash the kind of protest and civil disobedience required to attain justice in this new era. As Wells would write in exile, first-class citizenship and rights would not be realized by education, uplift, and accumulation of wealth alone. For as lynching suggested, these were not agents of change in and of themselves. The values of stability and order had to give way to protest, a kind of protest that was possible in an urban industrial society. The race issue was not resolving itself. While blacks were attaining unprecedented positions of influence and power, blacks were being lynched, excluded from occupations that were being unionized, arrested to work on chain gangs, sexually exploited, and increasingly ghettoized and targeted. In the America she now imagined, the best and the worst could happen simultaneously. With her understanding of the worst and her optimism that she could bring out the best in her campaign, she set out to right the wrong of lynching. After the Moss lynching, Wells reminded her readers what the press had reported as his last words. "Tell my people to go west. There is no justice for them here," Moss had said. His last words were uttered with a realization that the Oklahoma Territory was opening up for settlement, and Wells urged that blacks heed the call. Within a short time, nearly 20% of the Memphis black population left Memphis for Oklahoma and other points west, depriving the city of both labor and consumers to the point that businesses teetered on bankruptcy. Soon after, Wells led a trolley car boycott, this still in 1892, that drove the company to near bankruptcy. They actually, the owners of the trolley car actually came to her newspaper office and begged her to encourage blacks to ride the trolley cars. As she wrote, quote, "To Northern capital and Afro-American labor, the South owes its rehabilitation. If labor is withdrawn, capital will not remain. The Afro-American is thus the backbone of the South, and a thorough knowledge and judicious exercise of this power in lynching localities would many times affect a bloodless revolution." She is talking about civil disobedience on a mass scale. As far as I know, no one had done that before. The revolution was not going to be realized with the old idea of elites from each group negotiating with another. Wells advocated a cross-class insurgency that included laboring blacks, who she called the backbone of the South, and had hitherto been looked upon with suspicion by both blacks and whites. And if these strategies didn't work, Wells saw no gain in further sacrificing self-respect to appease those in power. Of course, she preferred the bloodless revolution. But citing examples from Oklahoma, she noted that the only times that blacks avoided scheduled lynchings was when they were armed and prepared to protect themselves. The lesson that this teaches, and which every Afro-American should ponder well, Ida wrote, is that a Winchester rifle should have a place of honor in every black home. And it should be used for that protection which the law refuses to give. The more the Afro-American yields and cringes and begs, the more he has to do so. The more he is insulted, outraged, lynched. Wells understood the radical implications of her message and was prepared to endure the consequences, even if, as she said, the heavens might fall. But she had made up her mind that her campaign, wherever it took her, was her calling, and that she would see it through and broker no compromise. She took her anti-lynching campaign to the British Isles, where she gained crucial support from supporters who ranged from British suffragists to the Duke of Argyll and the Bishop of Canterbury. The English trip was so important. England was the major importer of Southern cotton. So the image of the South was very important to maintain for the South. And when Ida said what was going on in Great Britain, you can imagine what the reaction was here. It was fabulous. Stateside, she traveled from New York to California, creating interracial, and this is largely known, creating interracial anti-lynching committees wherever she spoke. And when those committees formed, she said, "You know, I knew if you spoke the truth to the people, they would respond." Lynching became the center of the civil rights agenda of the NAACP, who was a founding member of. It was a movement that the anti-lynching movement culminated in the first national organization of black women, National Association of Colored Women, which was first inspired by Wells' anti-lynching campaign. Her use of observation and new social science methods, such as statistics, challenged the stereotypes of black men and women. As Ida Wells wrote herself, she said, "Somebody must show that the Afro-American race is more sinned against than sinning, and it seems to have fallen on me to do so." Now, of course, She did not eradicate stereotypes or lynching, but she provided a basis for social scientists who were more enlightened about race once her campaign began. Also, lynchings continually decreased after 1892, and there was even anti-lynching legislation passed in several southern states and almost passed by the U.S. Congress several times as it was brought to become a nationwide issue. And, of course, Eleanor Roosevelt was important to those later campaigns. Not Franklin, Eleanor. Indeed, Ida Wells's legacy included a way of thinking and a way of militating against injustice as a legacy that continues to reverberate today. It's a legacy, I think, that helps us to understand, to imagine, and to act upon that progress can be made in a country in which both the worst and the best is happening at the same time. Thank you very much.